Why don't we begin with a prayer this morning? Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Friend, Beloved God,
Jesus Christ,
Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashai,
Swami
Sri Yukteswar,
Beloved Guru,
Paramhansa Yogananda,
Saints of all religions,
we offer our lives
in service to Thee.
Bless this morning
and this satsang together
with Your presence
and with Your light.
We are children of Your light.
Bring us home to Thee.
Receive us. Om. Peace. Amen. So this morning we will be having a class on how I renew my inner life. And each of us will speak for a little bit about that from our own personal experiences. And before we do that, we will, and also I should introduce us. I'm Nayaswami Parvati. This is Nayaswami Savitri and Nayaswami Devarshi. So before we begin, we'll have some music. As I mentioned, the topic this morning is how I renew my inner life. And for each one of us, that will be a little bit different. But one quote I remembered that was very interesting, Swami quoted it a number of times in his lifetime, and it's from Revelations in the Bible. "I have seen your good works, but there is one thing I have against thee. Thou hast forsaken thy first love." And that's really what renewal is all about. Our first love is God and the Guru, Divine Mother. And we are born into this world of Maya, Mahamaya, it's called, Great Maya. And it's a world of, as Jyotishin Devi so beautifully described, it's a world of constant change and very interesting, like a circus, like a great show. In India, they call it the Leela, and that means play. And we're supposed to enjoy it, but it's very hard to enjoy it unless we understand who and what we really are and why we're here. Without that, it is, Master said, he said, Maya will eat you up. It will just devour you. And it's true, it's what happens. Because if we're only living in that way that's outward, then all of our energy is depleted constantly. And we never feel that renewal, we never feel that joy inwardly, which is why we're here. We are that in essence, and without that, it's called a veil of tears, this world. So anyway, but I was remembering when they were singing the song this morning that Swami wrote that. I was living in San Francisco at the time, and I remember it was all in Italian, and I said, what does città mean? And he said, city, city. So, but I was in a place where it was probably one of the highlights of my spiritual life because it was so challenging. And just to be able to live in the midst of a very busy city and a very worldly city, very entertaining, lots going on other than spiritual things, and nothing to really remind you of that unless you had developed that deep inner center and could see life in the city from that vantage point. So I was thinking about the term renewal, and there's a number of kinds of renewal that we have. And I think the first one that we have in this lifetime is when we renew our connection with Master. And I love the way that Devi talked about that the other day. And I want to say a little bit again about my own personal experience of that. At one point after I had been on this path for a while, I realized that I was born in Los Angeles in 1946. I knew that already. but I realized what that meant in a deeper way was that, wait a minute, for the first 5.5 years of my life, and people always say, well, where in Los Angeles? Right downtown, right in the middle of it all. But for the first 5.5 years of my life, Master was alive and living in Los Angeles, not far from where I lived. And although it wasn't a conscious touch, it was still, I thought, and that was the year the autobiography came out. And I've wondered, well, maybe I came to Los Angeles because of that. Maybe I was drawn there because of that. My own family was a good family. There were no strange energies going on in our home, and everything was very supportive and loving, but not at all spiritual, not overtly spiritual. The word God really was never mentioned. And it wasn't a negative thing, but just no real way to relate to that reality, that deeper reality. And so that time, then we fast forward to high school, which, as Devi mentioned, you know, if you ever want to worry about, think about why you don't want to come back, just remember high school, you know, which was always trying. It's like, who am I? Who are they? What is our relationship? Why am I here? You know, and why, the big question for me was, why do people treat each other so badly? And I couldn't kind of ever resolve that. And I kept thinking, well, when I get to college, it will be better. And you know what? It wasn't. In fact, it was worse in certain ways. It was more nebulous and a lot of angst going on and people trying to figure out who they were and what life was all about in yet a more deep way. And for me, that occurred in Northern California, especially in San Jose, in the late 60s. So it was really an interesting time. I hit college in San Jose around 1966 to finish up my degree there. And interestingly enough, at that time, Sadhana Devi and I connected. She lived down the street from me. So we've known each other for a long, long time. No spiritual connection, but just friends, you know, that kind of thing. So, but I knew that there was something more in life, and I really was trying to figure out what that was about. I was ready to graduate from college, and the main question that came to me, I thought came to me, was, I can't graduate. I don't know who I am. And so what was my response to that? I took off that semester before graduation and traveled in Europe for 3 months. And after a few weeks of travel, I thought, well, this isn't it either. This won't answer my question, who am I? But at least it will be interesting and it will give me perspective about what life is about, what it looks like outside my own culture, that kind of thing. So it was very valuable. But then I moved along, and by the end of that time, I knew it was spirituality I was looking for, but I really had no idea what that meant. And so the next 3 years, I explored. Now, right at that moment, I went to Santa Barbara for a summer school class, which didn't happen, but I was there. And I was exploring spiritually, just somehow meditation was in the air for me. And I went into a bookstore, and I was saying this to someone, and someone said, you ought to read that book. And it was the autobiography of a yogi. And at the time, I knew nothing. I looked at it and I thought, well, I don't know, India, it's so emotional and, you know, he looks like a woman. And I couldn't relate to it at that particular time. It took me 3 years to come back to that place where I could really relate to it. At any rate, I was kind of enjoying life, but what happens is once you put out that soul call, and you know that's what you really want. And I was challenged in that, by the way. Not so much by my family, but by what was happening all around. San Jose State was the scene of some of the most intense demonstrations with tear gas and political and a lot of crazy people running around. It was really a fun time in a way, but just, wow, what was the right thing to do? And I remember I could feel deeply within it was spirituality that would answer my questions and nothing else. And I remember a man who was very politically, you know, radical, and he came in and was talking with me, and I said, spirituality. He said, oh, you're copping out, huh? And I said, yeah. Sounded fine to me, you know, because I could see what he was doing was going nowhere, was just going to run itself out. But at any rate, so I experimented around. I graduated. I still didn't know who I was. I went to work at the welfare department in San Jose, which was really an interesting experience. Sadhana Devi had worked there as well, I think. Anyway, but then there came a point, and it's very interesting as you look back on these things. I was 24, and really the bottom dropped out. I just thought, I can't do this. I've got my BA, send it to my parents. You know, it was very sweet. I mean, they were very supportive, but I just, that didn't mean anything. I went to work. That was strange. And we weren't really trying to help people. We were trying to police them, and I thought, I'm not into that. So, but at any rate, by the time I was 24, I'd worked a year, and the bottom just dropped out. And I thought, I cannot live like this. And it was like, you know, when Krishna opens his mouth in the Bhagavad Gita and shows Arjuna all of who he really is. Well, it was like Divine Mother opened her mouth and said, this is what life will look like for you if you continue on in this way. And it was meaningless. It wasn't horror. It was gray. on forever. And I thought, I cannot do this. So I thought, okay, save every penny you've got, 6 months, quit, and look for what you really want. I knew it involved meditation. I knew I needed help. I knew I needed support. And so I did that. I was with someone at the time. We, at the beginning of January, cut it, and we're going to travel. And right at that point, walking by the campus, which I was no longer involved in, San Jose State, was a man with a van. Out of the back of the van, he was selling Be Here Now. And somehow, that quirky book, it's very quirky. We have a copy at home. I looked at it and I thought, huh? But somehow, Ram Dass was able to capture the sweetness of the guru-disciple relationship. And that, at that moment, after the bottom had dropped out, I thought, that's it. That's it. Now, we were still planning this trip, so we went traveling, went all up and down from the Bay Area, clear up to BC, Canada, and back. Didn't find anything. There were hundreds of little communities started at that time, but it wasn't our karma, my karma, to do anything else. And so came back to the Bay Area and found a flyer for a six-week course in meditation and yoga postures. And I thought, oh, postures, okay. Meditation, yes. Went to the first class. On the way to the class, we went to a bookstore. And my frame of mind at the time was, I don't think I can stand to go to one more spiritual bookstore and look at books. It was done. I really wanted something. And when you put out that soul call, Divine Mother listens and makes those arrangements for you. So at that point, we went to this bookstore, yes, and I thought, okay, well, now that we're here, I need a good book. Biographies are always good, so let me look for that. Looked on the shelf, there was the autobiography. Didn't jump out at me, but I thought, oh, big, inexpensive, yeah, it'd probably be fun. So I pulled it off, and, you know, again, not conscious enough to say, wow, but I pulled it off, I bought it, and then we went to the first class. Well, this first class of this meditation series, we didn't know anything about who was teaching it. It happened to be taught by a man, Kirsi Bulsara, who was a student of Swami's and the year before had just taken over all of his classes in the Bay Area. So he taught this class, we learned a lot, we meditated, and he told us about Ananda. But again, it's interesting how this unfolds for you. He made it sound really difficult to come here. He said, well, you know, if you're going to go up there, you really need to be together. You need to have money, and you should probably take a business with you because they need that. And I thought, well, I'm kind of together. I have a little money, and I don't know anything about business, you know. So I thought, but this sounds really good. So my friend and I came up, and we came up in August of 1971 for a couple of different weekends, camped out. Satya was there, greeted us, let us just camp in our car, and, you know. But it was so wonderful, because backing up to that class and buying the autobiography, when Swami said he read it in 3 days, that's what I did. I opened that book, and it was just, I thought, wow, this is it. I couldn't believe it. And we had nothing. We had rented an apartment. There was no furniture in it because we weren't sure what we were doing at that point. But at any rate, reading that and then visiting Ananda, and there was nothing here. There were a few little domes at the meditation retreat. Swami gave classes, all of that. But what I felt deeply and immediately was it was the same vibration as the autobiography of a yogi. And it was thrilling to me. It was like, wow, how could this possibly have happened to me out of all the things that could have happened? And so I came back and then the next summer moved here. And again, that feeling really continued. And it was Swami Kriyananda, yes, giving everything, Saturday satsang, at night Sunday service, fire ceremony, talking to people, being at lunch, talking to people afterwards. I was just blown away, but what I felt was not only his energy, but the people around him, people who are still here today. Jyotish, Devi, Seva, Sadhana Devi. I kept looking at Sadhana Devi and thinking, do I know her? I hadn't seen her in 3 years. But I just saw people who I felt, they're normal. They're like me. If they can do this, I can do this. Anandi was another one. She had just come here the year when I visited. But it was really just a thrilling, thrilling time. And it continued on that way. Mm-hmm. I have a picture of about, I think it's 1973, and it must be a work day. It may be a work day for the market. I don't know. I had just started the market at that point. And it's really rough. I mean, there is no sign. The market looks pretty rough. And, you know, just the porch, and people are walking around. And I can pick out me, the fellow that I was with, this other fellow that started the market with me, maybe one or two other people. All the rest of them are gone. But even so, I looked at that and I thought, wow, how did this come out of that? And it's really the renewal. So you renew your commitment to this path. And I did that at that time. I just thought, I can't believe how lucky I am and how free I feel in my consciousness. There was nothing here. Why would I feel that? But it was the path. It was the vibration. I could feel when we read in the Bible, Jesus Christ came by truth and grace. That was here. Truth, yes. Grace, the power, yes. To be able to do this path and to be able to walk this path. So that's one kind of renewal. The other kinds of renewal are more periodic and daily as well. Seclusion is a given. We have to, and you have to do this. Everybody has to do this. I say this to myself, I say it to all of you. Every year, take seclusion. No matter how hard it is, do it. Because without that break in the normal daily routine, you don't renew. You just keep going and going. And I think it's partly why people keep going and fall away. Because there isn't that sense of really touching into the deepest part of what this path has to offer. Leaving everything else behind. We're not here. As Swami said, and again, over the years, we had to put out a tremendous amount of energy to build Ananda, every single person here. But he would always say in the midst of some great campaign, don't forget why we're here. We're here to find God. Don't ever forget that. No matter how busy we get, we're not here to build buildings. We're not here to do campaigns. We're here to find God. And so that renewing, that coming back to that all the time, very, very important. So seclusion is vital. No matter how hard it is for you, do it. It will happen, and it will revitalize your spiritual life in ways that nobody can tell you about. But it's important also, you know, in our society, there's a feeling of, I don't want to be alone. You know, what will happen to me if I'm alone? Well, seek out being alone with God. Seek it out. Really go for that, because it's only when you're alone that you really get to know who you are. And in reality, all the reality that is you and God. That's it. Nobody else. When you die, it's you and God. There's nobody else that can do anything for you. Nothing. You know, maybe they can mop your brow or something, or say om in your ear, but in which, you know, please excuse me, it's not to make fun of that by any means, but in the end, when things are really happening, hear and master and Divine Mother is the only reality left. And if you get to know that now, little by little, then when that time comes, when all the energy's in, up, and you're going out, you can go from this point. You can do that because you've renewed all the time. The other kinds of renewal that I've found helpful are just dive into the moment. You know, Swami, in the Bhagavad Gita, the essence of the Bhagavad Gita, which I highly recommend that you read regularly, and the index has all kinds of topics you can refer to in the Gita, but he said a very interesting and somewhat daunting thing. He said people look at their spiritual life and they think, well, but it's hard and I don't have time and all that, and everybody outside looks happy. And he said, you know, people in my neighborhood, the families, the children, everybody, they look happy, you know, so what's the problem? He said people live in the hope of happiness. That's it. And it's always like that carrot out there. Oh, if that, the hope, it's never real. And it's why at the end of life you look at people and they're drained, they're dry, they're dried up because it never worked. Like me, looking to college or something that would bring people who were kind to each other and treated each other in the right way. Never happens unless you go inside and you find that inner part of yourself, which then you're connecting with truth. Then you're connecting with that deepest reality. Another way that I've found helpful to renew my spiritual life, inner life, but spiritual life, is to put it first. It has to be, and in fact, Swami said this to us one time. He said, you know, people say, well, I'm trying to understand how to integrate my spiritual life into my business life or my family, you know, into my family life. And he said, I'd like you to seriously consider turning that around. How do I integrate my business life, my family life, my whatever, into my spiritual life? Because the spiritual life, if it's not at the core, it won't happen. It just keeps kind of getting piecemealed away. But if it's at the core, then every single decision that you have to make, every delusion of Maya that comes your way, that may or may not be okay, who knows, but every single thing, you have a place to refer that back to, and that is your only deep commitment to the path. With that, it's like, you know, the puppet. You pick it up by that string, and everything else can fall into place. You know, there was an interesting, very simple interview with the Dalai Lama recently that appeared in Time magazine. And he was asked the question, have you ever smoked dope hot? And he said, no, never. He said, no, and what do you think of it? You know, what do you think of that? And medicine, you know, medicinal things. He said, no, never. He said, if some doctors feel that's good, then they can recommend that. But he said, the human brain is made in such a way that things like that are poisonous to the brain. They affect the consciousness, in other words. He didn't put it that way, but he said, no, never, and don't. Yeah, it was just interesting to hear him talk about something like that. And he was very real on other topics as well. But just that whole ability to put, and I would watch Swami over the years on little things, because if the spiritual life is the core, then there are reasons to do or not do many things, and some of them are small, but it's like we're keeping our commitment to master by doing everything we can. I watch Swami never eat meat, never even
like Caesar salad dressing with just a little tiny thing of anchovy. Nope, not that. Never drink alcohol. We were in Italy at one point and sitting in a family home, and they insisted on serving all of us wine, all of us. And so we're sitting there thinking, okay, what are we? Swami, his spilled somehow, miraculously. I can't remember what I, you know, because it's offensive, you know, so we didn't want to be offensive, but it's like, you know, so I think we, and then, you know, left. But just in the small things, and then more in the last few years, I can't remember where he said it, but he said, you know, being on the spiritual path and being more and more in tune, he said it's little constant acts of will. Little constant acts of will. You know, we think, oh, renewal, you know, this big thing, but it's really renewing by the minute, by the second, by the, just those little constant acts of will that bring you more and more into line, into alignment, into attunement, deeper and deeper with your spiritual path. So, other things, I think one of the things that's been most inspiring to me is thinking about, in a way of renewal, is thinking about that divine as a friend and as the whole path. I like the concept of the divine romance, and it's just very sweet to think about. When Jyotish was saying the other day about Divine Mother being consciousness, that's how I've always related to Divine Mother, as consciousness. And, you know, I've often thought, oh, it would be so wonderful to have a painting of that, but I've never been able to imagine what that would look like as consciousness. But just that whole feeling of that divine presence is with us all the time. All that happens to us is that we're either closed to it or we're open to it. And as we open to it, then that divine starts to interact with us. And it's not just opening. We have to open with energy. We have to open with consciousness. And we have to keep the heart open. But doing that, then we find that that divine presence is there all the time, and it's with all of us very intimately in every atom of creation, for heaven's sake. And so we're able to start to see, again, as Jyotish and Devi were mentioning, and Master said this, he said, you know, when you invite the divine in, that divine will take away everything that's keeping you from it. And he said, you can't, well, I don't know if he said this, but you can't look at that as things that are being mean to you. They're things that are meant to free you. And it's breathtaking when you think about, and it's a good thing to think about as a way of renewal, of things going away in your life. Possessions, people, things you have, whatever. But just being willing to let those go, if it's your will, if it's the divine will, to let that go away. Because, again, when we look at, are those things helping us to go deeper, or are they blocking us from going deeper? And for each of us, that will look very different. You know, when you come to the center of the spiritual path, think about Swami and how he expressed himself. He was very free. He was a friend to everybody. And he felt fine about having a nice house and having nice furniture. And just, it was because it was always an expression out from his center with Master, with Divine Mother. So one last thing I'll say before closing is that the other part that's really important to pick up on is to really be aware of those moments when the divine is trying to come to you. and don't pass them off. One of the hardest things to do, we've all touched on that, peace, love, joy, light, sound, whatever it is, but can you hold it? Can you maintain it in your life every day? And that renewal is allowing us to hold, to maintain, to expand our territory where we don't have to be just in our meditation room. We don't have to be just in our little area. We don't have to be just at Ananda Village. We can be anywhere and feel that divine presence within us. I was thinking back to when in this room in 1982, Swami Kriyananda first offered the higher Kriyas here at Ananda Village. I had been here 10 years at that time, and it was a thrilling time. It was Babaji Day, July 25th, at that point we were doing that, and it was Sunday morning before Sunday service, which amazing that he did this, but offered all the higher Kriyas to several hundred people. And afterwards, it was so deep and so deeply thrilling that I was living in San Francisco at the time, and I remember walking out onto the porch out here, and I thought, you know, if I leave and go back there today, I'll lose this, a lot of it. And so I asked my friends, Diana and Ram at the time, and I said, you know, would it be all right if I stay here for a week? I really feel I need to. And they were willing to just take on my classes and whatever other duties that I had. It was awkward, but it was okay. But I thought, this is more important than anything right now. And just look for those moments in your life spiritually when that happens, because it is happening. If you ask for Divine Mother, if you ask for Master, if you want this path and want it more abundantly, it will come to you, but maybe you block it. Maybe you don't let it in. It's not convenient. It's not what you'd like to do right now, but really look for those, and as much as possible, try to open to them, because as you do, that will renew your spiritual life, your inner life, in ways that you never imagined possible.
Thank you, Parvati. I'm Nayaswami Savitri, and I'd like to share with you a few of the ways I've found to renew my inner life, my spiritual life. I was thinking about this topic and thinking, you know, I could make this class very, very short. Someone could walk up to me and say, what is the primary way that you renew your spiritual life? And I would say, by deeper, longer, thirsty, guru-given meditation. That's it. End of story. I can sit down now. But I would like to add, that of course is a line from Master's Poem Samadhi. I'd like to add to that, hope Master doesn't mind, by deeper, longer, thirsty, daily without fail, guru-given meditation. That's four things that I have to do, and then Master comes in and takes up the slack, which he will always do if we put out the energy, put out the effort to keep it always going. Master was so definite about how much we need to meditate, and daily and regularly and without fail, and even if we don't think we're doing a very good job, do it anyway. There's a story of Master, apparently one day he came out on the stage, possibly running out in his orange robes with his turban, and as we hear the stories and everyone leaping to their feet saying they're awake and ready, just visualize it, must have been wonderful. But for some reason, these people sat down, he said, you know, I'm tired of talking about all these things. I've been talking about a lot of things for many years about the spiritual path and how to do it. So today I'm going to give a three-word sermon, and here it is. Meditate, meditate, meditate. And he went and sat down. Well, I thought of doing that too. That would be a fun thing to do. Go sit down. But It is the truth that meditation is the core of the way we deepen our spiritual life, and that it is necessary for us to do it daily. A deep, long, daily, thirsty, guru-given meditation. And then, of course, as we've talked about this week, taking that into daily life, making all of our work into service, seeing God as the doer, feeling the presence of God in everything. All of those things, we're quite familiar with those. So I don't have to talk too much about that. I can move on to other things now. I would like to talk just a little bit about something that's been going on here in the community, which has been a lot of fun for people. One of our wonderful newer members here, Rachel Ebke, has been going around making these little video clips. And she'll just ambush someone and say, "Tell me why you meditate." And they will explain. And it's a little video clip, and it's on our website, and they're wonderful to watch. One of the most recent ones I saw, it really struck me. It was Prakash, and you might have seen it. I think he's here. I hope I'm not going to embarrass him too much, but it's just great. He's standing in this working man's outfit, nice Swami Prakash. It's blue, but it's a blue collar, and he's standing in front of his backhoe. Isn't it great that blue-collar workers who are Nayaswamis are in their right outfits? Anyway, he's standing with his backhoe behind him. He's talking about why I meditate, and it's so cute. It's so wonderful. We all know he's coming across as just this sort of guy, you know, and we know he's this wonderful, great soul. I'm not going to tell you what he says because I want you to watch it. And not only that one, all the other ones that people say why I meditate. Well, I haven't had one of these made about me, so I'm going to do it now. Why I meditate is because I can't stand not to. I simply cannot bear my life if I don't meditate longer, thirsty, guru-given meditation every day. Now, it was not always this way for me. Actually, it's very surprising that I can stand up and say that to you with all truthfulness right now, because in the beginning, something I did recently was a lot of fun. I decided to go back. My first summer at Ananda, I spent 2 months here in 1975 doing the apprenticeship program, which is what we call Karma Yoga now. And I had heard Swami speak during that. I got here in July, mid-July. I'd heard him speak maybe 4 or 5 times before Spiritual Renewal Week came along. And then he gave 5 days of classes, and they were just fabulous. And so I decided a few weeks ago, I wonder if I could find a recording of that first summer of one of those classes. And we have lots and lots of old cassette tapes in our house, old dusty, you know, going looking for them. So I looked and looked, and sure enough, there was 1975 Spiritual Renewal Week. I thought, oh boy, I'm just going to recreate that whole summer again. I'm going to listen to Swami and see what he said to me and why it obviously made a strong impression on me, because here I am still after all these, that's 30 9 years ago. That's a long time. What did he say? I must listen carefully to what he said, because it obviously did something for me. It was somewhere in one of the talks. He says, just this one line, he says, "I can't imagine how people can stand not to meditate. I can't even imagine how they can live their lives." And I remember when I listened to that this time, 39 years later, I remember thinking, there I am sitting in the old temple of trees up at the meditation retreat. I remember thinking, well, I know how they get along. I get along just fine. Yeah, I don't have to meditate every day. As a matter of fact, I wasn't meditating. I was trying. I knew I should. I knew there must be something to it. But I wasn't doing it very well. I knew the teachings, knew the goal. I came here to Ananda knowing the Yogananda, and that's why I was here. One of the reasons I came here is I was hoping and praying with all my heart that someone would make me meditate. You meditate every day. And I, much to my surprise, nobody made me. Everybody meditated every day, and that helped a lot. They created an environment for meditation, and I could fit myself into it. But I still had to do it. And so I did it. And, you know, I was pretty good when I was here, but then I went back to Texas and nobody else is meditating, and it's very hard. And that line of I don't see how people get along without meditation, I thought, well, yeah, okay. But I am very happy to tell you that 39 years later, I can add my testimony to that of Swami Kriyananda, that is the truth. Life is miserable without meditation. You may think you're having a happy life, but you're not. If you don't meditate every day, regularly, faithfully, guru-given meditation. So one of the main points I want to make today is there's a particular quality, a particular attitude that we all need to have to make this deeper, longer, thirsty, every single day guru-given meditation happen. I want to read to you from the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam Explained. This is quatrain number 28. Such a wonderful book. Every single word in it is like just so beautiful. And this is from I'm not going to read the quatrain to you. I'm just going to read the expanded meaning of quatrain number 28, and I want you to listen carefully for a term that's going to occur over and over. This is Paramahansa Yogananda speaking to you, speaking to me, so listen carefully because I'm going to give you a pop quiz. What is this concept? Only by steadfast self-discipline can we achieve true and lasting happiness. To foolish people, this inner work seems a prescription for self-torture. Self-discipline is, however, the only way to bring the unruly mind under control. By self-discipline, we succeed in transforming sorrow-producing patterns of behavior into those which give us inner joy. By self-discipline, the mind gradually frees itself from the meshes of delusion. By self-discipline applied to meditation, one finds the highway to lasting inner happiness. As years of spiritual practice invigorate the inner sun of wisdom, its heat evaporates the waters of matter consciousness. The soul, enlightened at last, soars in divine freedom. Isn't that wonderful? The soul soars in divine freedom. But what takes you there? It said it five times.
Self-discipline.
Yeah. Yeah, there it is, isn't it? There's that term. I never liked that term very much. Self-discipline. Oh, no. It's a little bit hard to apply that to yourself, isn't it, to say I've got to set the alarm 5:15 every morning the rest of my life, get up, do my practices before I go to work, come home tired, fix dinner for everybody, either meditate before I fix dinner or again before I go to bed, every day, self-discipline. I thought, you know, if I'm going to talk about self-discipline like this, I'm going to have to talk about it in a different way because it will depress me. I'm going to talk about the joy of self-discipline. I'm going to talk about how to make self-discipline a lot of fun. I came up with so many ideas about how to do this, I think I'm going to have to write a book, okay? And call it How to Have a Whole Lot of Fun and Be Self-Disciplined at the Same Time. Okay, because that really, that was the first thing I noticed here at Ananda, that everybody was having a good time. They were smiling, they were laughing, they were joyful. You know, when people ask Swami, what is the mission of Ananda? What would he say? Do you remember? Our mission is to
have fun.
Have fun. And then, of course, he'd go on to explain that means to have joy, to rejoice, to know what a wonderful thing this is we've stumbled across. I once heard someone say that one of the monks at Self-Realization Fellowship said about Swami, when he was here with us, the halls rang with laughter. And when he left, it wasn't that way so much anymore. Kind of sad. But I tell you, when I arrived at Ananda, the halls, well, there were no halls, but the teepee ringing with laughter. And the hills were alive with the sounds of music. And it still is that way. So let your self-discipline also be joyful. It just is going to have to be that way. Or else we're just going to stumble into what Arjuna did. I'm going to talk about him in a minute, just a second. And that's called the Yoga of Despondency. Okay. But I want to tell you a quick story about something that happened to me. I'd been here at Ananda for maybe, 5 or 6 years. I was leading the afternoon sadhana here in this room. And I was doing my best to be joyful, as I always try to do, because that's what I felt inside, and energization, postures, chanting, meditation. After it was over, I walked out into the hall there, and there was a man here. There were probably 15, 20 people at the sadhana, and he was waiting for me out there in the hallway. And I just walked out, and I said hello, and he said, okay, he says, now you can just come off at any time, come off the act. And I said, what? He said, nobody could be as joyful as you seem to be. You're just acting. I know you are. I've seen other people here. I've only been here a day and a half, but why don't you all just come off of it, you know, and be real here? Well, I was astonished, you know. I'd just come out of meditation. I was feeling great and blissful and all. And I said, look, I apologize, but what you see here is what you get. I'm not putting on an act. I said, I do feel joyful. And he said, yeah, right. And he did. He just turned and walked away from me. Well, I said a little prayer for him. I happened to know the man was going to be here for a week. And the poor guy, I mean, what was he going to experience? But I tell you, he had the integrity. Bless his heart. I don't remember him. I don't think I've ever seen him again. But he had the integrity at the end of the week to come back to me and say to me, I'm sorry for what I said to you. He said, I know now that it's not an act. He said, there is a wellspring of joy here, and it must be from what you're doing. And that is the truth. That's where the joy comes from. So be joyful in your practices. Swami used to tell us over and over, and don't try to just be joyful. Don't meditate to get joy. Meditate joyfully. Meditate in a joyful way. So I wanted to, before my time goes out and here, I wanted to just give you some of the little fun tips that I have found in working with making meditation more meaningful, more joyful, and to have fun with it. Okay, I hope I'm not harping on this too much, but I think it's pretty important, really. Okay, as many of you know who know me well, know that I work a lot with the chakras. And there happens to be a chakra. I'm going to give you another pop quiz here. It's like like school, isn't it? There happens to be a chakra that is most closely related with this concept I'm talking about, self-discipline. Okay, the self-discipline chakra. It's one that's pretty much devoted and dedicated to that. So think about it for a second, and then I'm going to ask you to hold up a finger. First chakra, second chakra, third chakra, fourth chakra, fifth. Which one is it? Okay, think about it a second. Okay, here we go. 1, 2, 3, hold up your fingers. Okay, I see a lot of threes out there. She's got a couple of ones here. Yeah, okay, it is number 3, because this is the place of fiery self-control. Fiery self-control. That means self-discipline, enthusiasm, joy for life. And who is the Mahabharata character who dwells there in the third chakra? That's Arjuna. And you can have a whole lot of fun with Arjuna. He's the general of your armies. He's the most powerful warrior that ever lived. And guess what? He lives right there inside of you. He's ready to offer you all the possible help that you can imagine. You can't even imagine how much help Arjuna can give you if you'll just bother to tune into it a little bit, okay? And that's just one chakra. You've got a bunch of other ones. But because I'm talking about self-discipline and making self-discipline a lot of fun, I'd like you to have just a little brief conversation with Arjuna and with another chakra, which I'm going to mention in a minute. So in order to do this, I'd like you to take your left hand and place it right here over your navel. That's where the third chakra is. Just sit up straight, because we're going to go into the spine. And when you go into the spine, you really need to feel the length of the spine and feel this area of the third chakra, the whirling, spinning ball of light. And now take your right hand and put it on top of the other one. And go inside yourself and feel the energy there. The energy of fiery self-control, of self-discipline, of loving self-discipline, of energy, of enthusiasm, of great joy, a very joyful fire burning there, burning away all your delusions, giving you strength and energy to walk this path. And now I'd like you to say mentally, not out loud, just mentally within yourself, say these words. Hello, Arjuna. Hello, Arjuna. Hello, fiery self-control. I'd like to know you better. I'd like for you to help me in my spiritual path. I'd like you to help me find my way to freedom. And you know what Arjuna says back to you? He says, I thought you'd never ask. So keep your eyes closed now and keep your left hand over your navel, and with your right hand, lift it up and touch the point between the eyebrows. And here we're going to meet another character from the Mahabharata, the one we've been talking about so much all week. This is the third eye, the spiritual eye, the point between the eyebrows, the Kutastha Chaitanya. But for simplicity's sake, we are going to call this Krishna, because this is the place of Lord Krishna, the one who drove the chariot for Arjuna. So in your mind, not out loud now, but just mentally, say, hello, Krishna. Krishna represents God, the Guru, the enlightened ones of all times. Hello, Krishna. Nice to meet you. Will you help me also? And of course, you know he will. And open your eyes now. Get to know your chakras individually. Each one of them has a different flavor, like a different flavor of ice cream. Each one of them is wonderful and can offer you all sorts of special help. Now, Arjuna, fiery self-control, in that wonderful, the best of all moments in the Bhagavad Gita, because it applies to all of us so much, is that Krishna, he's in Krishna's chariot. Krishna drives him out there between the two armies. And Arjuna looks at his loved ones and he throws down his arrows and his bows and all of his stuff and he slumps. And he says, I can't do it. I don't want to. I can't. I'm not strong enough. I don't want to do this. I can't do it. So this is called Bishad Yoga. It even has a name. The Yoga of Despondency. And we all go through it. We reach a moment where we go, I can't set that alarm for 4:45. I can't keep doing this. It's just too much. I quit. Slump. Throw down the stuff. But remember that Arjuna did exactly the right thing. Now, throwing down the stuff, not necessarily the right thing, but if you do it, and we all will, we have and we will, if you do it, do the right thing. What Arjuna did at that moment is he turned to his guru. He turned to Krishna. Remember also, this is Master and Babaji here, and they were in later incarnations, so the whole thing ties together nicely. Turned to his guru, turned to God, and said, help me. Help me. I don't know what to do here. I do not know how to proceed. Help me. And Krishna said, okay. I thought you'd never ask. Here's the Bhagavad Gita. Here's how to do it. You know, it reminds me a little bit of a story Swami used to tell. I hesitated for a second to tell this, but I think I want to because it so illustrates an important point here. Swami says the story he would tell is there was a black man in the South who was accused of some crime, and he was taken into the courtroom, and he was poor, and he was, not knowing what was going on necessarily, and he didn't have a lawyer. He was too poor for that. So the judge called him up to the bench and said, sir, how do you plead? And the black man looked up and says, judge, I plead for mercy. And nobody laughed at that. Is that not funny? Oh, dear. Judge, I plead for mercy. you know what I'm talking about here. Do I have to explain this joke? You know, you either say you either say I'm guilty or I'm not guilty. How do you plead? I plead not guilty. He says, I plead for mercy. Well, this is what we need to do all the time. We need to turn to our guru, turn to God, and say, oh, give mercy on me. And they will. They love you so much. That's it. We just don't ask enough. And we don't have enough fun with our meditations. And we don't find, you know, I've found so many little tricks. This is what I got to put in this book. Little tricks to make myself meditate when I don't want to, you know, or to make it more fun somehow. One of the things I remember Master always said is that every single week you need to have a 3-hour meditation. Every single week. At least once a week you need to have a longer meditation, preferably 3 hours, where you can do all your techniques and take more time to attune yourself to God and gurus. And I'd always thought that was a good idea, and I had done it sometimes. But, you know, months would go by. And finally, in 1995, when Sudarshan and I moved back here, we'd been in Palo Alto for a couple of weeks, I knew that Nitai was leading a 3-hour meditation for men only over at the Crystal Hermitage Museum. And I thought, and there were no other 3-hour meditations going on, and I thought, well, I can't crash their party, but I'll just go down to Crystal Hermitage Chapel and do that, and maybe I can find some women or somebody that might want to join me. So I tried, but, you know, that little chapel is kind of cold. The Hermitage is nice and cozy. I mean, the shrine is nice and cozy. It has heat coming up from the floor. So they had the good spot. But I noticed as a few weeks went along, I would end the meditation, I'd come up, and Nitai was leading it, and there was nobody there but him. 2, 3, 4 weeks in a row, just him, and then it was only just me. Finally, I went to him and I said, Nitai, can I join you? I said, because you don't have anybody coming, and I don't have anybody coming, so maybe we could just join forces here, and maybe we could magnetize more people come. He said, sure, why not? So it became a co-educational, what is that the word? Male and female, okay, to come. That was in 1995. For 19 years, I have been leading. Nitai had to leave and move to somewhere else. I can't remember where he moved at that point. So I took it over. And what's been so wonderful about it is that I have to go because I have the key to the door. If I don't go, nobody's going to get in, or no, it's not going to be led. So I have forced myself through my own energy of, I have a strong vein in me of responsibility, not so much to myself, but to other people. So I tricked myself into having a 3-hour meditation every week. And now I'm just not sure how I'd ever get along without it. It's just so wonderful. But the alarm clock goes off at 4:45 on a Saturday morning. I've been working hard all week. Whew, it's tough sometimes. But I've been doing it so long that I just know it's going to be okay. I have a little song I sing as I drive in the cold and the snow and the rain over to the Crystal Hermitage on many mornings. And I get there, I open it up, the door, nobody's there but me. And I have this little song I sing. I was glad when they said unto me, let us go into the house of the Lord. And I just sing that over and over because that is the house of the Lord for me. All the relics are there. It's beautiful. I get there. I don't think about alarm clocks anymore. It's just blissful. But I had to trick myself into it. I often have to trick myself into energizing, too, even after all these years. You know, I had this thought comes into my mind, it says, I'm too tired to energize. Now, that's a great thought, isn't it? So I come back to that voice and I say, okay, well, let's just do the first one or two, okay? Step out on the porch here. And then, okay, well, you know, it leads me into it. And then I, okay, I've entered it. Now I feel like meditating. On it goes. Look into your own heart. This is what I want to say to you and leave you with this morning. Look into your own heart and say, how can I make this fun? How can it be wonderful for me? How can it be joyful? We all know that it is, but there are ways that we can enhance it. There are ways, and there are many, many, many ways that you can do it in your own personal and creative way. I'd like to close by just telling the story once again that you all know so well. It's in the path. And It's where Master told this story. He said it was like a vision he had. He was a young man. It was in the down in the hot, dusty marketplace, and everybody's kind of walking about being miserable. This is symbolic of the world and all of us in it. And he thought, oh, this is a terrible place. And so he looks up. This is always a wise idea, look up, no matter where you are. And he sees a mountain at the top. It's a beautiful garden and just crystal waterfalls and everything you ever wanted in the opposite of this dusty, hot hubbub of a market. And he looks at it and he goes, that's where I want to be. And then the next thought comes. Do you remember what that thought was? Oh, but it's too high. I'm never going to make it. How often did that thought come into my mind, into your mind? But then he turned around and said, but I can, what? Put one foot in front of the other. He went over to the mountain and started climbing it. And before he knew it, there he was at the top. So whenever you lose heart, whenever you lose faith, whenever you are feeling the yoga of despondency, turn to your guru and help you. And then the next thing you do is say, I can put one foot in front of the other. Thank you.
I'm going to talk about how the inner life, it implies that there's a separation and a difference from the outer life. And really, if you want to, for me, renew your inner life, you want to get rid of that separation and bring the two together. You want to bring your outer life into your inner life into your outer life. And it's just very, very helpful over time, you'll find, to renew your inner life all day long. And it's a great theory. It's a challenge, but it's a good challenge to pick up and try. But it helps in the beginning, and I'm going to start by just zooming out from the picture, because we get caught up in the details. And the life at Ananda is very busy. People who don't live here, I know your lives are busy, and you get caught up in all this stuff that's going on. And it helps just to zoom out and get the big picture. And one thing that really helped me with this was my very first winter at Ananda. I was living over by the Crystal Hermitage at Ayodhya, and there had been a lot of snow and freezing rain, melted, froze again, and even the trails were ice, not to mention the entire road going over to the Crystal Hermitage to the parking lot there was just almost like a skating rink. And one morning I came out and on my walk over the hill to the garden, and there was a single car there in the parking lot trying to get out. And I just thought, come on, you can't be serious. Park the car, I'll have a walking partner to go over the hill with. And I went up to talk to the person who was in the car, and it was Jyotish. And the tires were spinning on this frozen ice. And you have to realize that in those days, the cars, it was probably about a 1967 Plymouth Valiant with bald tires, roughly, because almost all of our cars were that year and that model just about. And he said that he had to get over the hill because he had an appointment, I think, in town or something, and he needed his car. And so could I try to help him push it? And again, I was really dubious and skeptical. And so I started pushing, and he started, it was rear-wheel drive, so I could see the tires right there. And the idea was just to turn the tires just enough without spinning them, and I would push as hard as I could. And I found that if I pushed as hard as I could, the car remained completely motionless. If I pushed less hard than I could, it would actually start spinning and moving backwards. And so I stopped and thought, okay, I need to do more here. Joe just really feels like he needs to get over the hill. I'm going to try again. And I used more willpower and tried even harder. And I found that if I used more willpower, more than I thought I had, and more muscle than, you know, both of us, you have to keep in mind, were very, very scrawny looking young guys in those days, that the car could just inch along. Just, you would push as hard as you could, and it would just incrementally, inch by inch. And there was about maybe 100 yards to get to a place where there was a downslope. And after about 10 minutes of this, and, you know, not many inches, I stopped and I said, Jyotish, I don't know that I can do this much more. He said, oh, let's trade places. And so I got in the car. He started pushing. And he saw, at first I thought, well, I'm not a very good yogi. Let's see how it's done. And well, it was the same thing, inch by inch, just incremental. And you couldn't even slack up because the car would start sliding backwards when the tire started spinning. It was just like, I think it was Davey mentioning, that there's no treading water on the spiritual path. It's either swim and keep your head above water or sink. And so we kept going at this. And after a while, it became more of a spiritual challenge than anything else, because nothing could be that important that it would take half an hour or whatever it took to get that car going again. And finally, after trading places many times and pushing and going, and finally he reached a top of a rise. And once you get the momentum and get going, you don't stop and look back. I don't know that we ever even talked about it, or we didn't high five and because the outer life is the inner life in a way. And zooming back from that experience, you can see that that is really the life of Ananda. And it's everyone's life, our spiritual life. We have all these things that we're doing. And in the case of Ananda, it's building Ananda against impossible odds. You look at it, and I think it was Parvati mentioned that I still look at the people who came here in the 1960s and 1970s, and I think, those people built this? And it just doesn't add up. But you'll find that in the end, it's not about the stuff that we have built or created. And in your own life, whether you're living in a city, raising a family, in the end, it's not about the stuff. And it's so easy to get caught up in the moment and the challenge and the car being stuck and the baby crying and our health challenge and this and that. And so remind yourself of the big picture. It's not about the things. It's about, in that case, it was about developing absolute determination and willpower. And everything that is given to us, really, and I'll get into this a little bit later, is given to us by God, by the Guru, to help us grow spiritually and to develop particular qualities that each one of us needs to develop. And so zooming out and seeing the big picture, understand that the outer life is not separate from the inner life. It's all the same. And so we're given these opportunities in meditation, in active life, and in the end, again, it all is one life. It's the inner life. But again, it's very difficult and challenging because we get caught. The energy starts going out. We forget about God. We forget about the inner life. And so we come to a time like this where we renew it. But it can be very difficult to go away from a week like this and bring it into daily activity. People, I can't tell you how many times I've experienced it. I've had a seclusion. I go very deep. I think, boy, I've got it now. When I get back into the world and back into the challenges, nothing's going to shake me. And then, you know, very first day something comes along and knocks me over and I forget all about it. And so the way out of that sort of trap is, again, is to bring the inner into the outer into the inner. Sister Ganamata, who, great saint, she said that one's religion is tested in the cold, hard light of day. And I think a lot of us, very early on in the spiritual path, we hear that and we think, if it wasn't for that darned cold, hard light of day, this would be so easy, wouldn't it? But in fact, really, all the cold, hard light of day does, it just shines a light on what we need to work on spiritually. And you'll find, again, if you bring those two together, that what you develop, in the case of pushing that car, willpower and determination, and the determination to succeed, even when there's just incremental progress, and even when there's incremental progress, not just over minutes or an hour, but over the years, you find that that spiritual quality carries you deeper into meditation and closer to God. Now, the challenge sometimes is when these tests come, because the tests knock us off of our game, make us forget about God or our great resolutions and our great determination. And so you need to find a way to use the tests to really, in a way, and this may sound strange, to renew your inner life and somehow to bring God into those tests. I was dealing with different karmic challenges, and I was thinking of who is the role model for people who have karmic challenges on our spiritual path and who have overcome. And it's Sister Gaudamata. And she went through a period of 20 years, the last 20 years of her life. And she, I understand she almost died like four times, and she was sick the whole time and just had all these really incredibly challenging health problems. And as I started thinking about that, and Swami Kriyananda one time said that in a way she was a good example of what the guru-disciple relationship, because she always followed and trusted the guru. But he said, in a way, it's terrifying, that model of the guru-disciple relationship, because of what she had to go through, even though she received final freedom in the end. And I started thinking, well, it is terrifying. Let me think of a model that's a little bit closer to my my own level of spirituality. And I finally remembered my dog, Cindy, when I was growing up. It was a lot closer to where I'm at. But she actually was a very inspiring model in a particular way. And it actually showed me how Sister Gaudamata and others get through these challenges like that. Cindy was just an extraordinary dog, kind, the kindest, gentlest, most loving dog in the world. If you thought yours was, yours is now in second place. I'm going to tell you that. But very few things stressed her out. But one of them was when we had to clip her nails. And when we clipped her nails, the crunching sound of the nail would just make her, she wouldn't howl, she would scream every time one of those nails crunched with that clipper. And I don't know if it was painful or what. And I know that she didn't know what was going on. I don't think she did. Why are these people doing this? This isn't a problem for me, it's their problem. But what I do know is that she knew that she loved us unconditionally. She knew that we loved her unconditionally. And because of that, there was an absolute trust that whatever was going on, it was for the good. Because she wouldn't bite, she wouldn't scratch, she wouldn't claw. She just sat there and screamed as we were doing it, but continued to be very loving and gentle. And I thought, this Sister Gaudamata, this is why she could go through 20 years of tests with seemingly no light at the end of the tunnel, is because she had unconditional love for the guru. She knew that the guru had unconditional love for her, and because of that, she had trust that whatever was coming to her was coming from God and was coming from the guru. This is what Jyotish and Devi, I think, alluded to this at one point, that once you get onto the spiritual path, Swami Kriyananda, when he asked Ananda Moyi Ma, what is this about, when he was thrown out of SRF, his biggest test, and she said, it's the guru's grace. And he said it took him a long time to find that and accept it, but he finally realized that that's what it was, because it helped him to grow spiritually in just the right way that he needed. Someone asked Ananda Moyi Ma one time, why, we're all children of God, but why are some treated badly, seemingly, and some treated with a pat on the back? You know, and even maybe disciples of the same guru get different treatment. She said that it's like a mother teaching a child how to walk, two children, and one of their children, their personality and their nature, they need a hand held and soft cooing words and encouragement to learn how to walk. The other one is maybe a more rough and tumble type, and they just need a shove in the back. And or people who are a child tossed into the pool to learn how to swim for a certain type of personality. And so when we have that love of the guru and we understand that and that attunement to the guru, and then when we give our life to the guru, as again we've heard this week, open your heart to me and I will enter and take charge of your life, then we understand that the guru is in charge of every part of our life. And it doesn't matter whether it's good or bad. Trust that everything that comes to us is to help us to go in a particular direction. And sometimes the only way a teacher, and thinking of school teachers when I was a boy, could get a boy to go in a particular direction was to take his arm and twist it up behind his back and lift it up and push him in a particular direction. And so trust that even though it seems like it's a challenge or pain or why is this happening to me, this isn't a very spiritual thing to happen to someone, is to get you to go in a very particular direction and introspect and bring the inner life into the outer and the outer into the inner. Now there's another aspect, and these are all really just different parts of the path of Kriya Yoga in a way that we've all been talking about this week. Another one, and this is really the greatest one, think of the most difficult challenge in your life, the one that causes you the most grief. Maybe it's a recurring challenge, it's an addiction, it's a health challenge, it's a person. Think of that in the context of what Swami Kriyananda says. And this is about devotion. It is love of God that gives you the power, as Paramahansa Yogananda put it, to stand unshaken amidst the crash of breaking worlds. This is something to remember, to write on your heart, because it's the truth. Nothing will take you down if you inwardly always love God. In fact, when you're really in love with God and in tune with the divine flow, you find that nothing else matters very much. You understand that things happen as they ought to, and that ultimately everything works out for the best. Let God solve your problems. People who are very worldly have a tendency to laugh at devotees as impractical. What they can't figure out is why things somehow go so well for those devotees who don't worry too much about any of the things worldly people consider so important. But when you love God and put your trust in Him, you find that He solves your problems for you, through you. All you need is to be enough in tune, and your intuition will guide you. The way to achieve that attunement is through devotion, and in that devotion, to uplift yourself in Him and let Him work through you. Now, God's not going to do everything for us. It would be too easy. And because God wants us to also have to put out the energy, I think, thinking of that story of Jyotish and I pushing that car out, I think if you were to zoom out even further and put on your 4D glasses, you would see that the guru was probably there helping us to push that car, because looking back and thinking about it, I think it was impossible to get that car out of a frozen skating pond that was going uphill with bald tires and all that. So the guru doesn't do it for us. Sometimes when we're probably oblivious but sincere, he might. But generally he does it with us when we put out the energy to cooperate with him. But coming back to devotion, that's one, it's partly it draws the power and the help of divine grace in the guru. But devotion really is part of the science of yoga. We don't think of it that way very often. But in fact, I think more and more someday they will study the science of devotion. They're finding that people who pray with love, it does affect the brain and does change the brain and it does change people. In terms of the yogic science, there's a few ways that devotion really is a yogic practice. One is that, as Jyotish was talking the first morning, when we get trapped in our problems, ourselves, and into this maya that we've been talking about, it's on the level of feeling, or citta. It's the feeling, the emotions, the waves of the heart that go outward and ensnare us in that way. And devotion, simply as a yogic technique, it takes these feelings, and because we're trapped on the level of feeling, more than of mind or anything like that, it takes the feeling and reverses that flow from emotion engaged in restlessness outwardly, turns it to God, which essentially just reverses that flow inwardly into the spiritual eye, where we are united with God. So see devotion as something that is also very practical as a yogic technique. It also does something else, which is that when we start practicing devotion, we start turning our identification from this little self to the divine self, to the infinite self. And so this is why when you have devotion, you can stand unshaken amidst the crash of breaking worlds. It's because when our karma comes, the breaking worlds, whether it's individual karma or mass karma, if we identify with this little mud puddle of our little self, the incoming rock of karma hits that puddle, and it doesn't just create waves, it obliterates the puddle and sends mud flying everywhere and causes all kind of mayhem in our lives, and we react and we get all upset about it. The same rock coming in, if we identify with the ocean of spirit, it just makes a little blip as it hits the water, the ocean, disappears under the waves, doesn't even affect underneath, just barely on the surface. And so devotion turns our identity to our true self. Now, with individual karma that comes, and this is a great experiment to try, I would encourage everyone to try this. Again, take your biggest challenge in your life, whatever it might be, and make it a practice that every day when that challenge comes up, the thought comes up, maybe it's a regret or, again, an addiction or a health problem, make a vow every time that comes up to turn to devotion, to turn to God. And this doesn't have to be some sort of ponderous, heavy thing. It can be a very, very light thing. It can be a very joyful thing. Swamiji tells the story of St. Teresa of Avila, who was serving God in elder age, and I think we've all heard the story, and she was riding a horse on the way to start a new convent, and it threw her into this frozen, raging current, and she almost drowned, and she got up on the other side, and she prayed to God and said, Why are you doing this to me? And she heard Christ appear to her, and Christ said, this is how I treat all my friends, Teresa. And as we probably all know, Teresa said, no wonder you have so few, Lord. Make it humorous and joyful. When you go through these things, when you suffer, that song was beautiful that they sang at the beginning here. And so when you suffer the, whether it's victory or the pangs of low defeat or indignity that we all have to go through, go to God and say, Lord, this is how you treat your children. Come on, give me a break here. And somehow try to find a way to turn any negativity, any sadness, any energy going down the spine, emotions, to divine joy. I can tell you that it's possible. And that way you can actually use your tests, which I think, again, that's why God gives them to us, the Guru gives them to us, is to help us to learn to be unshaken amidst the crash of breaking worlds and really amidst anything. And that really is what unconditional bliss, unconditional love is to be experiencing and feeling that under all circumstances. I would like to say, actually, I've often said, and I'm going to change how I say it from now on, which is that I've often said, never forget who and what you are, which is one with the infinite. And when we remember that, all our problems are solved. Again, the biggest rock of karma just creates a blip, and we just experience divine joy. The problem with saying never forget who and what you are is that we forget every 5 minutes who and what we are. So I think it's better to say, keep trying to remember throughout the day and experiment with ways to do this. You'll find that if you just work at different ways to bring, again, inner life into outer life and vice versa. And I've experimented with different ways. One way is just if you have a physical pain. Every time you experience the pain, there's a tendency for the mind to kind of go, oh, not this again, and the mind gets negative. Make it a habit. And it is can become a real wonderful habit that every time you experience that, your mind turns to God. And you start, you know, yelling at God or teasing God or having fun with God and saying, so this is how you treat all your friends, Lord, okay? But find some way to turn these things around and you can actually make it a habit. Find other ways throughout the day to renew your inner life. I do it with every time I turn the key on and start the car now. It's a time just to tune into God, practice devotion. Every time I brush my teeth, every time I wake up in the middle of the night, you'll find that when you add one by one these different things, you'll find that throughout the day, you're checking back into God more and more often. And you know, it's not that you're remembering all the time who and what you are, but you're remembering more and more often, and you'll find that it gets you through anything in life. Now, there's another sort of science of yoga that this works with devotion, which is what Jyotish was talking about, the still prana, the first morning. Because again, when we identify our consciousness more with the ocean and with that vast, calm depth of the ocean, then we start becoming one with that deep, still life force and prana. And all of these things really is the science of yoga. It's the path of Kriya Yoga. It's the science of any true yoga path. And it's hard to sort of think that devotion is part of a science, but in fact, it is. The great yogis discovered these things. There's a website that I visit occasionally. It's called Life Hacker. And it's about people who have hacked life in different ways. And it's, you know, fun, trivial things about how to cook an egg in a really clever, better, fun, new way that someone discovered and they share. And essentially what the yogis are doing is that they have hacked the spiritual life for all of us. They first yogis, they didn't have these techniques. They didn't have the science. They practiced devotion, and through a lot of effort and hard work, they finally found realization. And they realized, man, this could be a whole lot easier if I had just known this, the technique of Kriya Yoga. If I had just known this, the importance of energy and life force control and the energization exercises, if I had just known about devotion. And that's essentially what the great masters have done, is they've shared with us this whole science of Kriya Yoga, the spiritual path with us, which are just simply tricks about how to find freedom more quickly, more easily. And when the anguishing monotony that people have talked about becomes very, very strong, you start becoming more and more determined. And finally, you reach the point where you say, okay, I'm going to do every single thing that you say because I want joy and infinite freedom more quickly. And it's not just a theory in the end. That's the beautiful thing about Ananda and people who have been doing these things for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, is that you get to visit here and see people who have been doing this for their whole life. And you look at them and you see, these things really work. These things, it's not just some great promise that people are making. In Russia, there's a saying about when you're kind of just making a lot of promises, like the people, my wife Maria told me about it in the communist era, that when they're making all these grandiose promises or lies, it was hanging noodles on your ears, was the expression. And we're not just hanging noodles on your ears when we talk about these things, because people here have experienced them. Yogis for thousands of years have experienced them. These things really do work. So take these things, take this week back into your home life. Not only renew your inner life, but renew your outward life and find a way to bring the two together. And you'll find that eventually they all becomes one more and more beautiful, more and more joyful dance with God, dance with the infinite, and that all of that becomes one. So blessings on all of us with our spiritual practices. And as we take these things later this week, back into our outer life and bring that into our inner life.
With every breath I breathe, Lord, my God, how shall I worship thee, Lord?